especially if it was on a Monday morning and they had a bit too much to drink the weekend before. Office workers, even in the midst of the week, tended to take long and frequent breaks to go out and have a cigarette or drink some tea, and usually far more than were officially authorized. In fact, Russian workers even had a saying about all of this. They said, "They pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work." And indeed, as this suggests, another way of this sort of quiet gestures of dissidents were telling jokes, of which there were plentiful numbers of jokes, most of which were in subtle ways critical of the system, critical of its hypocrisies, critical of its lies. In addition to all these minor gestures of defiance, there was a larger trend in Soviet everyday life, which Soviet sociologists themselves and many other observers often noticed, namely what's been called a massive withdrawal of people from public life, from the world of ideology, from the world of building socialism, and a withdrawal into private life, a withdrawal of time, a withdrawal of energy, and of course of their sentiments, of their feelings. And this, what might be called rising culture of private life, took many forms in the Soviet Union. For example, it meant focusing one's leisure time on things like sports rather than politics, or on popular music, which meant both Western music, which began to be imported, some of it not fully legal, but also Russian pop music, which tended not to sing about politics. Most important, though, this withdrawal of energies from public into private life meant an increasing focus of energies and values on non-public concerns, above all, family and friends. One sociologist talking about this growing attention to family life talked about a widespread drift toward domesticity in Soviet society, in Soviet life. A cozy home for most Russians became much more important than building a new society or criticizing imperialism or even joining the official fight for world peace. These were the major public causes of the day. People spent more time on family life, and including on their home, on their physical spaces, which they decorated with various material objects, a piano, furniture. They displayed china. They picked out nice wallpaper. This is where people put their energies and even their values. Even more important, perhaps, is people focused their attention increasingly on friends. Many Russians, in fact, focused as much free time as they had on their small circle of trusted friends. Friends became a place for emotional bonding, a place which for men often meant activities mixed with a good deal of heavy drinking. Friends were people you could turn to for help in emergencies. Friends were people you could talk with honestly. You could tell jokes. You could find out really what's going on in society. They would help you out in every way possible. In fact, according to one, again, Soviet sociologist, though echoing the studies of many, friendship became, and I quote, "one of the most important pillars of morality in the Soviet Union, the basic foundation of people's judgments and values and commitment." Now, a related sign of cultural changes that were turning people away from the status quo, from political values of the regime, were the everyday cultural lives, especially of young people. The Soviet press, in fact, is filled with articles lamenting the lack of a good Soviet consciousness among young people, or even what was sometimes called widespread hooligan subculture. The way people dressed, young people dressed, was, for example, seen as emblematic of the problem, and indeed was an important sign. Lots of people were writing in, and articles appeared in various scholarly and sociological journals to complain about the clothes that young people were wearing. This meant, of course, Western jeans above all, which were very popular by the late 70s and 1980s. And these jeans rather typically tended to look like Western jeans and for good measure often had a nice big label on the back with some Western name written on it. Though many of these were actually made in East European countries, not in the United States or even Western Europe. By the early 1980s, one even begins to see young people dressed in various popular punk styles with brightly dyed hair and chains and safety pins in their ears and the like. Another very visible sign, especially of this growing separate dissident, in subtle ways, dissident youth culture, was widespread graffiti, which began to appear all over the walls of major cities in the Soviet Union, even out in the countryside. And here, too, one sees what might be described as signs of sort of alternative identities among young people who tended to put up most of this graffiti. We see, for example, graffiti indicating sports fans for various clubs, especially soccer and hockey clubs. And indeed, one sees not only graffiti showing one's identification with one's favorite sports team, but various colors connected to them, a special unofficial language connected to these teams, and even violence connected to one's primary important identity with one's favorite soccer or hockey team. Graffiti indicated rock fans as an important form of identity, people identified with their favorite bands. By the early 1980s, there was lots of graffiti to be seen in the Soviet Union with names of favorite bands, much of it in English, naming the popular Western rock bands like AC/DC or Kiss or Metallica. One saw this all over the walls of major cities, but also Soviet rock bands, which tended to emulate Western styles. Graffiti also indicated people's identity as a certain type of fan. For example, one would see references to what were called in Russian metalisti, that is to say, fans of heavy metal, or rockery, fans of rock and roll, or even breakery, which were fans of break dancing. One also saw graffiti that indicated even more countercultural identities, a countercultural group, sometimes vaguely political, such as graffiti that indicated a group person associated with pacifism, belonged to a group that was against the army or against the war, for example, the war in Afghanistan. There was graffiti associated with hippies, whose goal was to disengage not just with Soviet politics, but with the whole outer physical, material world. Graffiti representing the ideas of anarchists or people who considered themselves to be punks, emulating punks from the West, especially England and the United States. Even graffiti by neo-fascists, by fans of Hitler who would periodically gather and beat up hippies and punks and others. In addition to these subtler forms of defiance or alienation, or maybe these were simply ways of coping with society and creating a sphere that was one's own, we can also see more direct, more engaged, even public expressions of dissident values. Many of these, though, emerged in those special private spheres that were being created, sort of extended and interlinking circles of friends. For example, one sees the formation of religious groups of all sorts, Christian study prayer groups, for example, secret Protestant groups. It wasn't unusual if one went, especially in winter, to one of the big public pools in Russia that are shrouded in steam, to find baptisms by Protestant groups taking place in these public swimming pools. One found the formation of Hebrew language study groups among Jews, or groups that engaged in the study of Eastern religion, especially Zen Buddhism. Most pervasive, though, were what might be described as private cultural circles that formed in individual apartments, salons, one might say, to use a pre-revolutionary word, or even better, krushki, these circles of the intelligentsia. These, too, began to form in these years. And at these sorts of gatherings, in these private circles held in people's individual apartments, friends and acquaintances would gather to talk. They talk about books, they talk about events, about ideas, about values, and they tell the latest anecdote. They would read poems or even stories or even novels that couldn't be officially published. And they would sing. Especially they'd sing the very popular songs of what were often known as the bards, these singer, songwriter, poets who performed their own composed songs to their own music. Songwriters that were particularly popular, such as Vladimir Vysotsky or Bulat Okudzhava. And these songwriters, these bards, as they were often called, were popular for a number of reasons. Part of it was that at least for the educated, which was a larger and larger group, remember, they expressed feelings that about what really mattered to them, what really mattered, honesty, truth, stories about human suffering and endurance, of which there was so much in Soviet life, friendship, love, and the individual and the individual feelings. These were what these songs featured. This is what made them so popular. This is what to which people were turning. For example, a very popular song by one of these bards, Bulat Akhundzhava, a Muscovite, though of Armenian-Georgian background, was rather typical. The song was called My Arbat, and it referred to a street in Moscow, indeed to a neighborhood in Moscow, where lots of intellectuals and artists live. This was their world, and indeed, it evoked old Russia. The buildings tended to be not the new modern Soviet style. Listen to just a few of its lyrics to get a sense for the style. Ah, Arbat, my Arbat, you are my calling. You are my joy and sorrow. You are my religion. There is no cure from loving you. You are my fatherland. Never can one reach your end. You can see this is rather far from the heroism and collectivism and devotion to the public cause, to the Soviet fatherland that was supposed to be at the heart and soul of the Soviet view of the world. Now, these gatherings and apartments were also sites for exhibiting and talking about nonconformist art. And it's worth briefly looking at some of the trends, describing some of the trends one would see in the art of the period, which was not official, which was shown mainly in apartments. A lot of it was nonconformist in its subject and mood, especially in mood. Much of it was rather dark and melancholy. It was not unusual for pictures to describe the real hardships of Soviet life, of alcoholism, of illness, of sickness, of poverty. Some of it was abstract, simply dissident in style. Abstract art was not approved. Some of this art expressed sort of a basic existential doubt about the world, dark, shadowy figures. Some of it was quite religious, with images of crucifixion being featured. And much of this art tended to ask big questions about life. For example, a famous painting of 1975 by an artist named Viktor Pivovarov was entitled and had these words on the painting, I could depict an apple, a couch, and a whole bunch of other objects were described and pictured, but it said on the painting, how can I depict the life of a soul? And also some of this art was quite ironic. Pictures of Brezhnev made in a sort of parody of official art, images of the happiness of Soviet life, but clearly made to be ironic. Now, much of this nonconformity I've been describing can be found among the educated, a growing population, of course. But one sees similar trends in even a larger group of population, of the population that one could see by looking at what people were reading. Not the books published in huge numbers, which would be Lenin's collected works or Brezhnev's collected works, for example, but what people stood in line for, what they tried to get out of libraries, what they demanded, what they really read. And when you look at popular literature, certain patterns stand out. First of all, perhaps most pervasively, were stories about individuals and their families and their friends, about personal life, about friendship and love, about spiritual growth, inner growth. What's really telling is what one almost never finds in these popular stories and novels. We don't see workers fulfilling the plan, much less over-fulfilling the plan. We don't see stories about the heroism of communist revolutionaries or stories about the future in which socialism would be realized. In fact, most polls indicate that average Soviets were becoming rather pessimistic about where the future was heading. By contrast, in this literature, certain themes stand out, were popular. Stories about the war were very popular. For example, the novels of Yuri Bondriev, about national unity we see in these stories, about the heroism and suffering of individuals. And of course, these stories were filled with exciting accounts of adventure. And indeed, reading these stories was part of a nostalgia people were feeling for the war, when life had meaning, when you knew what was right and wrong, when the nation was united. Crime and detective novels were popular, such as the writing of a writer named Yulian Semyonov. These were also escapist in large part. There were gangsters and cops and extortion and criminal language. There was also simple pleasure in reading these stories, but there was also justice, always won out in these accounts. Spy novels were popular, serving similar functions of entertainment, as well as a sort of subtle nationalism. And science fiction was popular, though much of the science fiction lacked the optimism that one used to see in Soviet science fiction and had a surprisingly dark view of the effects of technology and machines. Novels, for example, featured machines that measured the work of art by how many ahs were uttered by onlookers, or accounts of a green cleansing rain and pervasive servo robots in a society that make it impossible for an artist to find any true untouched nature, or a computer that so dehumanizes the workplace that human beings have no place there. By extension, another very popular theme were stories about rural life, romantic stories by writers such as Valentin Rasputin, which tended to emphasize people's closeness to nature in the countryside, how life was simpler, how people were more honest. And many of these stories were set in Siberia, sort of romantic, wild nature, where people's basic human qualities are tested. Now, all these themes suggest all sorts of complex patterns, similar to what one can see in art and in the music of the bards, but certain things stand out, I think, very clearly. One is a desire to escape from ever-present official ideology, from its falseness, from its pervasive public gloss over reality, from the sort of grandiose and rather desiccated public oratory one heard from one's leaders, from the simple pomposity of power. The sheer monotony of official Soviet life. This literature and art and songs were an escape. No less important, one sees a sort of spiritual, existential, one might say, searching for the real meaning of life. A clear desire to focus on really what is most fundamental, what's human, about personal desires. To consider crises and what it tells you about a human being, people's accomplishments. Again, to focus on the individual personality, what makes people human, or to use a word that was used then, as it was used so many times before in Russian history, on Lichnost, on the individual and what makes them human. It involved a search for morals, for a moral code that had nothing to do with classes or the interests of building socialism, but was rooted in human nature, in what was universal and human. And, of course, a concern not with building the future, but with how to live for today. Finally, we come to the face of Soviet alienation, of dissidents, that was really best known, the underground illegal dissident movement. Much of it started informally in these private spaces, became targeted, though, because of its increasing publicness as illegal, and hence became fully a dissident movement from the late 60s to the early 1980s. This is a very diverse movement. It's diverse in tactics. It included publishing forbidden books in what was called samizdat, self-publishing, or even what was called tamizdat, from the Russian word tam, over there. In other words, publishing it in Western Europe or America and smuggling it back in. It included circulating petitions against repressive acts of the state, such as the arrest of writers or artists. It included participating in various public demonstrations even, often at the foot of some major statue such as Pushkin or Mayakovsky, with certain expectation of arrest. This movement was also diverse in its ideas and values. Lots of different groups were formed in these years, most of them focusing on what might be described as particular types of denied rights, denied group rights. Feminist groups, for example, formed to fight for real women's rights in the Soviet Union. Groups of Christian religious believers, especially Protestants, formed to gain more rights for themselves. Jewish groups formed. National minorities organized various groups. Workers even united to form to fight for free trade unions. But if we go beyond these specific issues, beyond specific denied rights, one sees certain ideas, certain ideological tendencies that unite as well as divide groups. And we see three in particular. The first were people who might be called and sometimes call themselves true Leninists. In other words, Marxist dissidents. This was the smallest tendency within this movement. They argued that real Leninism guarantees liberty, guarantees real democracy, guarantees true freedom, and that this democratic socialist spirit, existing only at the beginning, had been crushed by Stalin. For many of them, they looked at the 1920s, the period of NEP, as an ideal time to be returned to. One of the leading activists in this small movement was a historian named Roy Medvedev. Another group, what some have called neo-Slavophiles, also small but growing, aim to return Russia to its lost national culture, to rid Russia of this alien imposition, Western imposition of Marxist communism, to return to the natural moral values of old Russia. They had dreamed, in fact, of creating an essentially rural Russia again, an Orthodox Christian Russia, rooted in fundamental values that were part of Russia's past. And the principal voice for this point of view was the famous writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Most dissidents, though, were neither Marxists nor neo-Slavophiles. They were essentially liberals. They were essentially Democrats and fundamentally reformist. They didn't, in fact, even propose, at least for now, destroying communism in Russia. What they wanted was for the Soviet Union to live up to its own official liberal, democratic, humanistic claims and even laws. They demanded real civil rights, real personal liberties, respect for the individual, respect for individual dignity and rights. And the leading proponent of this point of view, the most important public voice, was the famous physicist Andrei Sakharov. Now, these are important, these ideological distinctions, these issues about denied group rights, but really these are just superficials for understanding this movement. They don't really explain what motivated dissenters, what inspired them to actually put their personal freedom, even their personal lives, at risk, what made members of different groups, however different about issue and ideology, cooperate, talk together, even in many cases become close friends. And there's a lot of answers to this question of more deeply what inspired people to become dissidents in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. One of these was certainly a key motivating ideal shared by all of them. The idea of human rights, of the rights of man. In other words, the old intelligentsia ideal of the dignity and rights of a human being as a human being. They all shared this. This was for all of them an inspiration, as it had been for the intelligentsia as far back as the late 18th and early 19th century. No less important, though, was something still more subtle. Though I should say that in speaking of this, I'm speaking not just as a historian of Soviet and Russian history, but also from my own personal experiences living in the Soviet Union in the 1980s as a student and scholar. It seems to me that one of the things that most distinguished dissidents was an inexplicable inner drive, a sort of personal drive, a moral drive to what they would describe as living for truth above all else. Judging the world, judging their own lives, judging the society in which they lived, not on the basis of convenience or habit, what's made life easiest for them, but according to absolute universal principles, according to morality, one may say, rooted in the nature of human beings, the nature of what they thought was true everywhere. A good friend of mine who participated in this movement in the late 1960s described this determination to me with the following words. One day he said, "We simply decided to live as if we were free, to no longer live a lie." In other words, to say openly what many people were thinking and feeling was true. Of course, in reality, these dissidents were not truly free, even if they tried to pretend they were, as an act of rebellion. For their brazen defiance, the government acted to silence them in all sorts of different ways. They were called in for what were called chats with a local KGB agent or the state prosecutor, extremely intimidating conversations. They might lose their job. They would lose the right to publish if they were a writer or an intellectual. They might suffer arrest. They may be sent to the gulag, imprisoned, sent to camps. Some, indeed many of them, were sentenced to a mental institution. How could one be so insane as to continue to challenge a system when one knew that one would be punished for it? As you might recognize, in all of these things, this dissident movement had much in common with earlier generations of the Russian intelligentsia, with Novikov and the Decembrists and Belinsky and Herzen and others that I've been talking about. In fact, it may be most useful to think of these dissidents of the 60s and 70s and 80s as intelligenti, in the full richness of this term in the Russian context. People living for principles, principles rooted in the nature of the human being, and being willing to stand up with a moral critique of the status quo in the name of principles. One final word about all this is in order. Although Western observers noticed all these developments, indeed so did many Soviet scholars, this everyday dissidence, which was noticed, few of them spoke of it as a sign of a systemic crisis in the Soviet Union. People saw this, they didn't understand or see that this was leading to some deep fundamental crisis challenging the system. Some Russians, however, did, in particular sociologists and psychologists, but even some Soviet leaders. And one of these leaders who recognized that all of this was leading to a fundamental crisis that had to be addressed was Mikhail Gorbachev, who became party leader in 1985. Soon after he came to power, he began speaking openly about what he and others had been observing for some time, that much of the population had become visibly alienated and disenchanted from the established order. That the Soviet Union, in other words, faced, in his own words, nothing less than what he called a spiritual crisis. In Russian, a duchovny krisis. Literally, or more figuratively and deeper, it may be translated as a cultural crisis. This sense of a spiritual crisis meant a crisis about values, about beliefs, about judgments, about tastes. Gorbachev's attempt to resolve this deep spiritual crisis, coupled with a growing economic crisis that I've already described, is the subject of my next and final lecture.
Lecture 36, Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika and Glasnost.
As I've mentioned, by the early 1980s, the leadership of the Soviet Union recognized a growing crisis in Soviet society, slowing rates of economic growth, which undermined this very critical implied social contract to provide people with a decent life and an improving life. And no less important, deep and widespread alienation from the very fundamental values of the system itself. In March 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was made head of the party, general secretary of the Communist Party, with a mandate to address this crisis. And his first step was simply to admit that it existed at all, to admit it publicly. For the first time, in fact, government and party leaders were encouraged to talk openly and honestly about economic problems in the country, to admit that economic growth was slowing, to admit that it had terrible effects on people's standard of living. In fact, people began officially to talk about stagnation in the economy, what soon became a sort of key term for describing the Brezhnev years. But they also admitted a fundamental cultural, ideological crisis. Gorbachev began immediately to speak openly from the platform of head of party about many of the phenomena that we've been talking about. Withdrawal from public life into private life. Widespread problems of alcoholism and even rising drug addiction. Pessimism, cynicism, especially among the youth. Weakened respect for work was a phrase he often used. In other words, a spiritual crisis, a crisis of belief and values. And his solutions to this crisis was two-pronged. First of all, political and economic reform, restructuring, as it was called, using the Russian word perestroika. This meant, for example, encouraging in industry greater responsibility among managers of various industrial enterprises to ensure economic efficiency. Simply put, if they couldn't make a profit, couldn't balance income and costs, they would simply have to close their factories. It also meant in the political sphere allowing multi-candidate elections to local office. This was in 1987, where candidates were encouraged to compete and debate issues so people could choose who would be better. In 1988, this was extended even further by creating a new body, a Congress of People's Deputies, elected in the course of national elections with multiple candidates for every seat. The goal, of course, was to re-involve citizens in public life, to feel that the government was connected to them, that it was theirs in many ways. The second prong of this reform to address this looming crisis was what became known quickly as a policy of glasnost, using the Russian word. This meant a policy of greater openness, of greater honesty, of greater discussion about the actual problems of public life. This included honesty about the past. Especially this meant honesty about Stalinism. In recent years, under late Brezhnev and in the rules during the rulers following him, the tendency was to discourage people from remembering the bad things that happened under Stalin. Now this changed dramatically, and indeed even other periods could be talked about, even occasionally the rule of Lenin. Press, television especially, was now filled with roundtables and discussions about the communist past, more open and more honest than anything ever heard before, even under Khrushchev. And honesty about the present was also part of what glasnost meant. A poster that appeared in 1987 was rather typical. A pictured on this poster, which was widely distributed in the country, was nothing more complex than rose-colored glasses having been discarded, lying as if taken off. And beneath it were written the words, "Let's take a realistic look at things." Given decades of lies and self-deceptions about the real conditions of Soviet life, these rather simple words, if sincere, and people assumed that they were a bold and radical declaration. We know, of course, what actually happened as a result of Gorbachev's efforts. His reforms encouraged a loosening of bonds throughout the system. Within the Soviet Union, people began indeed to speak openly about the problems and openly about solutions, about the need in particular for a more democratic, a truly market-oriented system, not just modest reforms in managerial responsibility. In Eastern Europe, where Gorbachev also encouraged reforms and where discontent with the system was in many ways even higher, it led to a wave of popular revolutions that swept communists out of power in 1989. In 1990 and 1991, the Baltic states in Georgia, where discontent was also high with its subjugation, the subjugation of these states to the Soviet Union. Here, these states demanded total independence in order to go their own way. And even in Russia itself, the Russian Federation, the center and core of the Soviet Union, a radical reformer, a man who continued to criticize Gorbachev as going too slow, Boris Yeltsin, was elected president of Russia. Now, conservative communists, convinced that Gorbachev was to blame for all this disintegration of the system in Russia and abroad, decided the time had come to act. They, in August of 1991, arrested Gorbachev and seized power, what became known as the putsch. Resistance to this coup, which included dramatic moments of Boris Yeltsin standing on a tank, a swearing defiance against the conservative communists, led to its failure within a matter of days. And in the wake of this coup against Gorbachev and his reforms, the Russian government, led by Yeltsin, banned the Communist Party in all of Russia, joined other republics that were at that moment quitting the USSR altogether, leaving the Soviet Union nothing but an empty shell, which would be abolished in December of that year. In fact, on Christmas Day of 1991, Gorbachev, now essentially president of a country that existed only on paper, a country that existed in, as it were, virtual, not physical space, recognized the inevitable and resigned as head of the USSR. This is a dramatic story, an important story for the world, but no less Fascinating is the story of the man who stood at its very center, Mikhail Gorbachev himself. And what this lecture tries to do is understand this man, what he was trying to accomplish, what ideas motivated him, and also why he failed, by looking closely at his values and his ideas. My source, I should say for this, are his own writings, his own speeches, which are plentiful with indications of where he was going even before he came to power, and then certainly after he became head of the party and then government after 85. First of all, to understand Gorbachev, it's necessary to understand his historical type. He was, and indeed in many ways still is, a characteristic true believer. Now, every society, of course, has its own official version of itself, what might be called its sustaining myth. These are the ideals by which a country defines itself. In the United States, for example, it's democracy and individual freedom and equal opportunity. This is our official version of what we stand for. The USSR had also an official version of itself, that it was the most democratic country in the world, the most just, the most humanistic, the most economically dynamic. Also, in every society, there's a certain discrepancy between these sustaining mythic ideals, this ideal about what the society should stand for, and real everyday practices, between ideal and reality. Needless to say, in the Soviet Union, this gap between ideals and reality was a yawning chasm. However, also in every society, there are people who find these ideals so powerfully meaningful, they can't tolerate any hypocrisy. They can't tolerate duplicity. Gorbachev and many of the people who were associated with him in his reforms was just such a person, a true believer. He took his country's official values, especially what it said about socialism and what it should mean, so seriously he wished them to be real. And this true belief was his source of both his reforming zeal, but also in many ways it was part of the reason he was unwilling to let reform go too far in order to undermine the socialism he truly believed in and was trying to make more vital. Of course, one has to understand how Gorbachev understood this official socialist tradition. And to do this, I want to focus on three key ideas that were extremely important for him and pervade his public statements. His ideas about democracy, about state power, and about moral order. Now, as you know, it's long been the official claim of the Soviet system that it is more democratic, was more democratic than any other, that the people rule, that socialism had produced a truer democracy than parliamentary democracy in the West, which, given capitalism, meant that actually, they used to say, the rich really ruled, not in the Soviet Union, where true democracy ruled. Gorbachev was the first Soviet leader, at least since the 1920s, to admit that the practices of Soviet socialism were far from democratic, much less expressing a higher democracy. But he wanted this dream to come true. He took this myth seriously. One sees this in his speeches before 1985 and afterwards. They're filled with talk about the democratic nature of socialism, though to be sure everybody was saying this, everybody officially. But we also see constant appeals for people to become more involved, to take more initiative. Indeed, this was the whole purpose of perestroika, of multi-candidate elections, the whole purpose behind Glasnost, to make this democratic ideal real. However, when Gorbachev talked about democracy, and he talked a lot about democracy, and when he talked about popular participation as at its core, he used these ideas in particular ways, in a distinctive manner. For Gorbachev, it's clear, real democracy meant orderly and responsible participation by the public in government, in public life. And for years, he lectured people about just this importance of order and responsibility. Starting in the 1970s, when he was party chief for the Stavropol region in southwest Russia at the foot of the Caucasus Mountains, starting in this period, his speeches were filled with arguments about the need to ground freedom in what he called civic responsibility, one of his favorite phrases. The need to link rights with responsibilities, to make criticism constructive, to preserve law and order, a favorite phrase of his. In January 1987, when he was General Secretary, he similarly made these same arguments in a speech before the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Socialist democracy, he said, and this is what he was trying to promote, socialist democracy is the organic combination of democracy and discipline, of independence and responsibility, of rights and duties. Socialist democracy has nothing, he says, in common with permissiveness, irresponsibility, and anarchy. Similarly, during his very last year in power, in 1991, this appeal for reason and order and responsibility became especially pervasive. And one can hear it in his attacks, for example, on Boris Yeltsin, who he said was too impatient, too extreme, too irrational, not sufficiently sober, by which he meant both in politics and, of course, in his own personal life. One can hear it in his criticisms of people he began to call so-called Democrats, who talked about freedom but didn't remember about discipline and responsibility. One hears it also in his attack on right-wing nationalists, a movement that was growing during the Gorbachev years. He complained they're too irrational, they're too emotional, they're too nostalgic. One needs rational and ordered democracy. Now, partly these sort of attitudes are not surprising in a man in his position. One can argue that this was about ideas about how he held power while trying to involve people in public life, how he kept control of the process of change. But there's more to this, I think, than just the logic of power itself. Partly these were pragmatic considerations. For example, he told a group of Belarusian intellectuals in March of 1991, the shelves cannot be filled without establishing order and legality in the country, without stabilization. But these arguments about disciplined, responsible democracy also reflected how he thought about power itself, about authority, about the very nature of the state and its uses. Like Lenin, his great hero, like also earlier reforming rulers in Russian history, so here in a way we come back full circle to Peter the Great and his successors, Gorbachev believed in the necessity of strong central authority in times of change. Throughout his career, Gorbachev frequently spoke about the important role the party played in Soviet history and Soviet life. Even when it was no longer necessary to make this claim, he continued to argue the party played a positive role. After, for example, perestroika was already underway, and after 1987, he continued to insist on the need for a strong political party that would be able, in his words, to unite all the healthy forces of the people to accomplish the historic task of renewing socialism. By early 1991, as he found the Communist Party and its members, especially its leaders, proving increasingly rigid and resistant to change, he began to shift attention away from the party toward the state and toward his own newly elected position as president, as head of state, elected by the new parliament in 1990, rather than to his role as head of the party. But the essential argument remained the same. Without strong central power, he said again and again and again, there can be no progress in Russia, in the Soviet Union. There can be no change. He insisted this is one of the laws of history, a phrase he often used. Or again, his words, such transitions have always required strong power. You'll, of course, recognize echoes of dozens of similar statements throughout Russian history, as we've seen in this course. Indeed, one of the persistent ideals in the history of the Russian state is this notion of the civilizing role of force exerted from above, as one scholar put it, writing about the 18th and 19th centuries. One sees it in the same sort of dialectics of power and progress being interconnected and interdependent as we saw in the 18th and 19th century. We see it with Gorbachev, too. Now, there's a second component to all of this, as often before. Not just strong power was needed in times of change, but it should be civilized power, conscious power. In other words, it's about the qualities of leaders, what makes power into effective authority. throughout his career, and reflecting these ideals of state power as progressive leadership, Gorbachev was obsessed with the qualities of leadership, with the nature, one might say, of this vanguard, this power that's going to bring about change, lead change. Already before he came to central power, Gorbachev began criticizing the inadequacies of leadership in the Soviet Union, though at this early stage, focusing on the inadequacies of local leaders. In 1975, for example, when he was party leader in Stavropol province, first secretary technically was his title, he criticized leaders that he saw around him who offered only, in his words, beautiful words, but no practical deeds, who held offices, but were completely incompetent in the area of responsibility they were given, who liked to boss people around, but not work efficiently with people to get things done, who were simply bad managers. By the early 1980s, as Gorbachev's own power grew, in 1980, in fact, he became a member of the Politburo. And one of the reasons he rose to power was indeed partly because of his own reputation as a good manager, as a competent leader. By this period, his critique of leadership became even more encompassing. For example, in a speech he made in 1983, he chastised many officials throughout the country for a variety of characteristic failings. Formalism, he called it, words not matched by action. Procrastination, he used a great Russian word here, volokita, which sometimes is translated as red tape. Inertia, sluggishness, self-satisfaction, these are his words. After he came to central power, after he became general secretary in 1985, he launched a major campaign against these evils of poor leadership. And in opposition to these evils, he launched a campaign in favor of the virtues of good authority. For example, again, his vocabulary, practical action, not just words, business-like behavior, goal orientation, effectiveness, responsibility, competence, honesty. These were the ideals he constantly talked about that Soviet leaders should have in order to make this transition happen. As you can probably notice, though, these ideas about democracy, these ideas about power that Gorbachev had, were pervaded with a rather striking moralism. The need for responsibility and self-discipline in democracy. The need for honesty and true commitment and ability in leadership. In fact, there is even a more sweeping moral vision than this in Gorbachev's ideas and the inspiration behind his actions and his talk about reform. He was, in fact, since the mid-1970s, constantly preaching a high moral code to anybody who would listen to him. While he was party leader in the Stavropol region, he frequently called on people, for example, to, his words, struggle against violations of labor discipline, acquisitiveness, theft, bribe-taking, and drunkenness, all real problems in Soviet life, afflicting even the leadership. In the early 1980s, when he became Politburo member, he again intensified this preaching to the whole nation to live a more moral life. He demanded greater intolerance of, again, to use his words, indiscipline, social passivity, parasitism, moral nihilism. And he suggested that practically that various social organizations in Russian life, especially those working with young people, help people spend their leisure hours in improving activities, sporting events, amateur artistic festivals he tried to organize, singing competitions on television, art exhibitions, things to raise people's moral level. And once he became general secretary, and after 1988, head of state, president as well, this sort of moral preaching, one might describe it as puritanical moral preaching, reached a real fever pitch. Among his first acts on coming to power was a campaign for sobriety, to end drunkenness, which was such a problem, so widespread, especially among Soviet men. Similarly, he launched a major campaign for work discipline, to encourage people to come to work on time and to work hard while there. Later, equally unsuccessfully, I should say, as these first two campaigns, he launched a major campaign against pornography, which was illegally available throughout the Soviet Union, and against prostitution, which also was illegally increasingly widespread. He also launched a campaign against what he called Western mass culture, the culture of the popularity of Western rock music, of jeans, of Western style of individualism, the spread of drugs, of styles of dress, and the like. In general, he's constantly in these years preaching to the nation about morality, about a whole list of sins that he noticed wherever he looked. Passivity, his words again, irresponsibility, arrogance, boorishness, consumerism, materialism, and even Philistine vulgarity, using a great Russian word, poshlist, with a long tradition of something the intelligentsia in Russia in the 19th century also hated. By the way, it's telling that in this light that Gorbachev's first uses of the now famous word perestroika, this was in the early 1980s, before he came to power, referred not to structural changes in politics or in the economy, but what he liked to call perestroika reconstruction of the mind, psychological perestroika, perestroika of consciousness, even perestroika of spiritual life. This is how he first used this term. What are we to make of all this moral preaching? Partly, of course, there are practical considerations. His awareness of the social and economic costs of moral indiscipline. This is especially evident in his concern with drunkenness among workers. It's part of his need for effective leaders, sober, responsible, honest leaders. It's also part of his concern with abuses of democracy by citizens. This was all can be seen as quite practical. But there's more, I think, than pragmatism involved here. I'd even say that for Gorbachev, ethics and morality went to the heart of his ideals about socialism, why he believed in socialism, why he believed that actual socialism needed a major overhaul. His speeches and writings in these years are filled with talk about socialism as humanism, about socialism as leading to the fullest development of the human person. And indeed, he uses that old intelligentsia term, Lichnost, the human personality out of which comes a natural dignity which should a society should recognize. He thought socialism could do this best, that it could best promote human dignity, that it could best promote what he called universal human values. As you can notice, by the way, these are also in some ways the ideas that pervaded the alternative political culture in the years before and during Gorbachev, the sort of ideas that were widespread among the educated in the 1960s and 70s, including dissenters, though, of course, with roots much older in Russian history. Where Gorbachev differed from this alternative culture, from many of his contemporaries, in fact, educated contemporaries, is that he believed that these ideas, these values were about socialism and could be used to revitalize socialism, to make it truly work. Which brings us to the question of why he failed. Why he failed to create a viable, humanistic, socialist society of which he dreamed. In part, the failure is simply practical. The economy, despite all his efforts, remained stagnant, partly, many say, because he feared pushing economic reforms too fast that might undermine socialism, but also old problems that were simply difficult to eradicate with any of the measures he adopted. Most of all, though, one might suggest, he failed because too few people shared his vision of socialism. Communists, for example, tradition-minded communists, viewed his ideas as undermining communism, as undermining the power and order of the system that was to them critical. This is why in August of 1991 they tried to overthrow him. Though, of course, as you know, the real result was really only to hammer the final nails into the coffin of the old communist order. More liberal-minded citizens also lacked his attachment to these ideas of socialism. They felt that the ideals about human dignity and rights and humanism pointed not to socialism, but to a free market economy and to a truly liberal democratic society without a role of a communist party at all. And many of these people were in fact determined to see more radical change than Gorbachev believed in or believed was safe. Their time, of course, would come when the coup against Gorbachev failed, when the communist party was banned throughout Russia, which was now independent, and when the USSR collapsed. The problem, as many discovered, is that freedom, which was gained in 1991, even truly democratic elections with multiple parties competing, truly free markets, a completely free press, freedom answers only some of people's desires and needs, the desires and needs that led them to be discontented with the Soviet Union. People also need, Russians certainly want, security in their lives, personal security, but especially material. They want their government to be effective and honest. They want to be proud of their country, have it respected in the world. And the dramatic collapse of communism in 1991 did not immediately or still solve these problems. On the contrary, while freedom truly flourished after 1991 in almost every conceivable way, the social order disintegrated. The economy declined precipitously, a 40% drop in the gross domestic product, the GDP, in only 8 years from early 1992 to early 2000. Almost half of the economy vanished, and only in the last couple of years is growth beginning. Growing wealth in the society besides widespread poverty. 30 to 50% of the people in post-communist Russia are still beneath the poverty line. One sees widespread homelessness and begging side by side with a class known as New Russians, with fancy apartments and independent houses and Mercedes and foreign clothes and Western bank accounts. We see disastrous public health conditions, most visibly in the dramatic drop in the age of death in Russia, which now is still only in the 50s for men. Widespread crime, both organized crime associated with the famous mafia, basically protection rackets, but also a great deal of disorganized crime, muggings and burglary, and even widespread murder. We see, since the end of communism and the coming of freedom, widespread moral breakdown, rising prostitution, increasing drunkenness, growing gambling, drug use, and a heightened wave of suicides. And one sees and saw in the years after the end of communism, widespread corruption in business, as it became privatized, and even in government. Though Vladimir Putin's coming to power in the last couple of years, beginning with 2000, has led to a decline at least of government corruption. To be sure, conditions have begun to improve in many ways in the last few years. More manufacture of Russian goods, a parliamentary system that is working tolerably well, a growing body of laws that are protecting individuals and institutions, and the continuing development of civil society, political parties, a free press, various civic organizations. And yet, most Russians are still far from living the life they most crave, what most Russians will simply call a normal life. So many social problems still remain. And yet, the majority of people in Russia are today quite patient. They've had their fill of revolutions, of utopian radical experiments, and indeed, there are slow, gradual signs of change. And perhaps, one might suggest, this time they'll win. And the sort of life that generations of Russians, many of whom we've looked at in this course, the sort of life they've dreamed of and tried so hard to create, a life that is free and democratic and prosperous and ethical, in which the individual really can live with the dignity he deserves, she deserves as a human being, that this sort of life will finally be theirs.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com. Or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.